This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today. When you're not feeling well and you go to the doctor, what are you hoping for from your visit? You probably want to get well, of course. But does it matter whether your doctor seems to really care about your well-being? Actually, there are reports that show it does. At the University of Wisconsin, a 2011 study of patients who turned out to have the common cold showed that patients who gave their clinician perfect marks for empathy recovered faster and had less severe symptoms than those who didn't. But doctors are people, too, and even as symptoms and test results play a role in how they treat patients, so too do emotions. Dr. Danielle Ofri has taken a close look at emotions in medicine in her work at New York's Bellevue Hospital, her occasional contributions in the New York Times, and her latest book, What Doctors Feel. She was in Milwaukee recently to give the annual Medical Humanities Lecture at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and she stopped by the Lake Effect studio to shed more light on the subject. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I was hoping we could start by talking a little about empathy, which you write a lot about. In fact, even if it's not the obvious topic of everything you write, I think you could probably find some subset of empathy in much of it. It makes sense that people become doctors because they want to help other people. But is that desire the same as having empathy for others?
I think they're related, but not necessarily the same thing. When we think about empathy, we think about, I think, the standard definition of can you be in someone else's shoes and look through their eyes? And in medicine specifically is can a physician or a nurse really feel how the patient is suffering? And really the origin of the words comes from sensing someone's suffering.
Well, and is it just the health issues themselves, or is there something about understanding the weight, if you will, of the medical system around them as a patient comes in the door?
Well, everyone's illness is unique, and partly because everyone's life is unique. And so how one person's pneumonia affects their life is completely different from another person's. If you imagine a healthy 36-year-old soccer player has pneumonia, out 2 days back playing soccer, an elderly widow living alone with pneumonia might send them to a nursing home. And so it completely changes their life, yet it's the same disease.
So do you think is empathy something that ought to be taught in medical school, or is it a question of recognizing it and having it reinforced?
It's an interesting concept. It's one of those things you would think is a little hard to teach. I think that we do a very good job of selecting the right medical students. I mean, honestly, in all my years of working with students, I can count on one hand the number of people who didn't really have what it takes to be a good and empathic doctor. However, when we finish training them at the other end, we know from a lot of research that their empathy is at the minimum sorely tested, if not really, you know, eroded. And so something about our training, I think, is affecting that. And so our efforts, not so much to teach empathy, but to preserve it and to model how important it remains in medical care today.
I wonder if there's something to the idea of students and young doctors being able to even simply recognize it as they're feeling it.
Well, partly, I mean, when you're thrown into the medical world, it's like being tossed into Mars without an instruction manual. It's very disorienting. The language is different. The way of dressing, the ethics, everything is different. And students who are keen observers, they watch how their superiors behave, how they walk, how they talk, how they address patients, how they address nurses, and all these things are picked up on. We often call this the hidden curriculum. So there's the explicit curriculum they learn about in the classroom, compassion, empathy, professionalism, and then there's what they see, how medicine is actually practiced in the field, and it's often quite different.
Right. You write at length about your own personal experiences having worked in labs and gone through classroom settings, and then when you're actually confronted with patients that are far different than anything you would have read about in just a textbook, it's a different story altogether.
It's absolutely different story, and I think we're just not prepared, and students aren't so prepared. Patients don't read the book either, and they bring their life to their illness, and it's really, you know, it's up to us to figure that out. And so when I look at who are the role models, they're the ones who in their practice would demonstrate empathy, to take the time to listen, to genuinely care. And those were the doctors who were different than the ones who were brusque and short-tempered, and you kind of know it when you see it.
Well, right. One of the really interesting personal examples you relate is that some of the most important lessons you received about meeting patients on their own terms came from doctors that we might have thought of as old-fashioned. But you write they exhibited something called clinical curiosity. What is that term getting at?
So most of my attendings were these starched white men in starched white coats and bow ties, and their white coats always buttoned all the way up. And our patients at a place like Bellevue, which is a public hospital, were largely immigrants, uninsured people, homeless people. And I always wondered, how will they ever connect? As we brought our attendings to the bedside, I couldn't imagine how this, you know, alcoholic, undocumented Honduran immigrant will relate to this, you know, gray-haired white guy with a bow tie. Yet, these doctors were very patient. They very much wanted to know what was going on with the patient. And they asked many questions. They did thorough physical exams. They were interested. And that interest in itself was a form of empathy and respect. And the patients got it. And they worshiped these doctors. They really felt these doctors cared about them, and they did. And so they didn't need to share the same characteristics. And these doctors didn't need to have been in the Peace Corps or backpacked in Nepal, but they were just interested in their patients, and patients pick up on that.
I wonder if, you know, I think about I have two fairly young kids, and they see doctors at kind of the rate that most children see doctors. And I think of all the pediatricians they've been in touch with, and it feels like there's some built-in empathy that comes with being a pediatrician. And maybe it's not built in, but I wonder if there's something to the idea that pediatricians don't necessarily come into a patient interaction feeling like their patients have made poor personal choices.
Well, one of the lovely things about pediatrics, which I really appreciated more as a parent than I did as a medical student rotating in pediatrics, is that, you know, kids, by and large, you know, they call it like it is. There's not a lot of premeditation. There's not much lying. It is what it is. And there's something really beautiful about that. Though when they actually study empathy, and there are scales that measure empathy, students who score higher on these empathy scales tend to go into primary care fields like pediatrics, obstetrics, internal medicine, family medicine, because they enjoy being with people. That connection gives them a lot of pleasure.
Where does humor come in? There's a lot of humor that you write about that doctors would probably find familiar and that patients might be a little aghast to learn about. But is it possible to have both empathy but also possess this kind of gallows humor that goes along with it?
You know, humor is one of those strange beasts. I mean, it's everywhere in medicine. And we all think, oh, this is so inappropriate. Yet I once worked with an attending in the intensive care unit who was from Tennessee, was also Jewish, if you can imagine kind of that Brooklyn humor, dryness, and Tennessee drawl combined together, who was always making jokes, and often at the expense of the patients. And I once confronted him, and he said, you know, everyone is dying here. What can you do but laugh? And I got his point, although at times it was awkward. I think that for many of us, humor is a way to handle situations that are very difficult. And as an attending now, as a senior doctor, I try to be very careful when I hear my team joking when it's not appropriate, but to recognize that the humor is a signal for something big, something uncomfortable. We're in that. We need to see what that is.
You also write, though, that people almost universally in the medical field attempt to compartmentalize what they're going through, and that almost universally it doesn't work so well.
No, it doesn't at all. And I think we use that as a coping mechanism. And to some degree, we need to be able to have some separation. I mean, often when you're with the patient, isn't the time for your own emotions to come spilling in. But if you don't attend to those emotions at some point, they will come out. A wonderful study of oncologists looked at the impact of grief. I mean, oncologists, their patients die at a higher rate than most of us. And they did try to compartmentalize, and universally it was a failure, that they would speak about grief would you know, follow them like a shadow. It would creep into their home life, their work life. It affected how they saw the next patients, and that it was a very real part of their lives, and they had to kind of negotiate an armistice with their grief. They had to face it, find a spot for it, but they couldn't ignore it.
Right. I think there's at least one medical center that you write about that that requires young oncologists in particular to go through, I guess these are sort of stress management seminars.
Well, this is in Rochester, where they have the oncology fellows meet weekly to talk about what's happened this week. And part of it is acknowledging all the patients who have died, saying their name, saying a word or two about them. And it's open to anyone, the secretaries, the, you know, the x-ray guys, if they want to come. But it's required for the oncologist to recognize that, you know, this is a very emotional field, and you must have at least a spot to say, I have to acknowledge that, boy, it was a really sad week or a horrible week or a frustrating week, and here are the people who I've lost.
You also point out, though, that it is difficult to definitively quantify how this dynamic affects outcomes, whether it cures more illness or manages more illness, say. At the end of the day, why do you think it matters?
Well, one of the things – and I come from a background of science. My PhD is in biochemistry, so I'm very much attuned to and respect hard numbers. But just because we can't quantify it doesn't mean it shouldn't be important. There are many things in life we can't quantify. At some point we say – this is important. I mean, listen, when you feel sick and you go Google your symptoms, you could probably come up with a correct diagnosis, but it's hard to imagine that you'd feel taken care of. And I think most of us, when we're sick, want to be taken care of by real nurses and actual doctors, not by a computer. And that difference between your medical cure and being taken care of, being healed, it's hard to quantify that, but we all know the difference. And we want to be taken care of when we're sick.
You're right, obviously, from the perspective of a doctor, but, you know, obviously you are a person that's also seen by doctors. And I wonder if most of us who are in the position of just being seen by doctors would be well served to have some thoughts about empathy in mind when they walk in the door of the exam room, not to necessarily empathize with the poor, overworked resident. But is there some role for the patient to play?
I think so. I think that when patients come in, they will get a quick intuitive sense if things are going well or things are not going well, even if they can't put their finger on why. And very often when things are not going well, it has to do with the doctor's emotional state, whether they're overworked, frustrated, whether they've been humiliated by their supervisors, and that directly affects patient care. And I think patients being attuned to that, they may not often have the position or power to change that, but they can be aware that something's going on and not to ignore that gut feeling. And if they feel strong enough, they can say, hey, doc, something's up. Or they can talk to a practice manager, or maybe it's time to switch doctors. But there's no reason to settle for a doctor who's an excellent technician but has poor communication or relating skills. There are enough doctors out there who possess both that we shouldn't have to settle for someone with a bedside manner that rivals a roll of surgical tape.
Well, at the same time, you recently wrote a column in the New York Times in which you consider really just how much it's appropriate to share with your patients, the fine line between empathy and getting in the way by oversharing.
Interestingly, you know, doctors often will share, oh, I had a colonoscopy too, so I know how it feels, or, you know, my father had that cancer. And I think we view it as a way to empathize and connect with our patients. But when these patients were studied, most of them found it actually rather intrusive. And I think finding the line of when you are helpful and when you're actually just expressing your, you know, your own needs and issues. And I think we have to really look at the patient, you know, needs first. And sometimes a little bit of sharing is helpful. But in general, if it hogs the spotlight, it becomes detrimental.
In the midst of all this, what do you get out of playing the cello?
You know, the cello kind of came in sort of randomly when my daughter was taking violin and the teacher suggested it would be helpful to see a parent practice. So I still – and last night I was practicing way before I went to bed. You know, one thing in medicine, once you've been in it for a couple of decades, your learning curve is there, but it you know, flattens a bit. Whereas being in music, I'm still the new student and I'm learning every day climbing the mountain, and that intellectual engagement, but also the aesthetic engagement. You know, there's not a lot in medicine about beauty. And I think beauty has a role in our lives for psychological health, for a place to filter your own emotions, for a way to bring joy. So I find it endlessly stimulating, and it makes me work hard in a way that just kind of keeps me going.
And do you think you're at the point that you're good enough that what comes out of your cello allows you to kind of feel that beauty and that joy?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily go that far, but I think the act of playing and striving, you know, so when you actually – and as soon as you get there, they move the finish line, so now you have a harder piece to play. And so you're always in the act of striving, and that in itself I think uses parts of your brain and your soul that make for a resilience that I think is helpful in patient care.
Danielle Ofri, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
It's a pleasure.
Dr. Danielle Ofri's latest book is called What Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine. She's an associate professor of medicine at New York University, practices at Bellevue Hospital in New York, and is an occasional contributor to the Well blog for the New York Times. She spoke with us while she was in Milwaukee to give the Medical Humanities Lecture at the Medical College of Wisconsin.